Well, today I thought what we would do instead of exactly continuing with Acts 11, 25, and 26 is to look at the precursors to the precursors to that verse, Acts 11, 26, and look at the prophecies that Acts 11, 26 foretold. And so it's the book of Isaiah. So Isaiah the prophet is the one that prophesied about this name, this new name, which the Lord would name and the Lord would give. And he prophesied about it three different times. And the first time is Isaiah chapter 56. Isaiah 56 verse 5. Where Isaiah prophesied, even to them, and this is God speaking, even to them I will give in my house and within my walls a place and a name. And then this name will be better than that of sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall never be cut off. So here we find out three things right here from this verse, that it's going to be given, God is going to give this name, and it'll be a new name, and it will be within the God's walls, which, of course, they did not know then, but we know now, that is in God's kingdom. So it tells us, it didn't tell them, that it wouldn't be, God would not give this new name until after God's kingdom was established. And then it will be a better name than sons of God and daughters of God. And then it will be an everlasting name that will never be cut off. So it will never end. It will exist through eternity. Kaufman said about this verse of prophecy here, the name referred to here is the name Christian. Isaiah prophesied that the name would be given not by God's enemies, but by himself within his walls and within his walls, that is within his kingdom. So that's what God meant, within his house and within his walls, means within his kingdom, which is the only house God ever had certainty, that God ever had. And it was certainly not the Jewish temple, which from the beginning was contrary to God's will. Isaiah also prophesied in Isaiah 62 verse 2 that this memorial name would be a new name and a name which the mouth of the Lord would give, and that it would be given after the kings and the Gentiles had seen the righteousness of God. That is, after God's kingdom had been established and after Gentiles were accepted into it. And so now we'll turn to Isaiah 62 verse 2. To look at the second prophecy on the new name that the mouth of the Lord would name. And out of the three passages, this is the most well-known of these three Isaiah prophecies. If someone just knew one of the prophecies, it'd be Isaiah 62:2, which reads, the Gentiles shall give your righteousness and all kings your glory. You shall be called by a new name which the mouth of the Lord will name. And Kaufman said, well, just looking at it here, the Gentiles shall see your righteousness. So that was an allusion that they did not understand and had no concept of until really. It was, of course, in Acts 10, but it took even Acts 11 for Peter to do the better explanation to the other Christians in Jerusalem for them to better understand this prophecy from Isaiah that the Gentiles shall see your righteousness, meaning that the Gentiles would be accepted into God's kingdom and be able to be forgiven of their sins as members of God's kingdom. And in all kings your glory, You shall be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord will name. So it'll be different, a new name that God would coin. And that was coined in Acts 11:26, the first time it was ever uttered. And it was by a divine revelation that it was a God-given name. And Kaufman said about this verse, again in this chapter, Isaiah prophesied about the new name that God promised to give his people. The prophet returns to the revelation regarding that new name, which was previously mentioned in Isaiah 56, verse 5, where the passage affirms that the name will be given by God himself. It will be given within his walls and in his house, which is his kingdom. Third, it will be a memorial name. Fourth, it will be a name better than that of sons of God and daughters of God that was known in the previously at the Old Testament and closer to the beginning, first time in Genesis chapter 6. And the fifth thing, as a reiteration from Isaiah 56, it will be an everlasting name that will never be cut off. We find ourselves absolutely astounded that so many present-day commentators profess not to know what God's name for his people really is. We will certainly attempt to clarify that. And I was thankful and I was glad that I had turned to these Isaiah prophecies and his commentary on that, because he had written extensively and a good article. Is like a 7-page article on this new name that I don't think we'll get to today, but we will get to. So Kaufman did an extensive study all to prove that Acts 11:26 was the fulfillment of these Isaiah prophecies, and that name is Christian that God named. But Kaufman continues here, Isaiah 62 is a continuation of the same theme which has dominated several of the preceding chapters, namely the blessings of God under the new covenant. Terms like salvation and righteousness identify the period envisioned as that of the new covenant in Christ. Some very significant additional information about that name which God promised his people appears in this passage. And there's three points that stand out. It shall be a new name, number one. And number two, it will be given at a time when the Gentiles have been accepted into the family of God and when kings have become aware of God's salvation. And the third point, there is a repetition here of the fact that God himself will give the name. And we'll go to the third passage that Isaiah prophesied, Isaiah 65:15. Prophesied about this new name that God would give, of course, from Isaiah's time, sometime in the future. But it would be after God's kingdom was established, and even beyond that, after that, even to the time after Gentiles were accepted into the his kingdom. But Isaiah 65:15, Isaiah wrote, "You shall leave your name as a curse to my chosen, for the Lord God will slay you and call his servants by another name." Well, they'd always been called the children of Israel. So that name that God, that they had gone by previously, was Israel. And that would be removed and replace his people, those members of God's kingdom, not by birth now. It would be through obedience. And then those righteous members of God's kingdom through obedience would be called by a different name, and it would no longer be Israel. They would no longer be children of Israel. And Kaufman said about this verse, "The ultimate fate of those who reject God will result in their name becoming a curse. The thought is that the name of the wicked nation has so defamed and degraded the name of Israel that God will have to create an altogether new name, called here another name for his people." This is the third passage where the new name is promised. There are seven earmarks by which that new name may be positively and precisely identified. And then this is where he writes his summary and his overview in an article over the seven identifying characteristics and factors of Isaiah's prophecy for this new name, which the mouth of the Lord would name. Now we will turn to the fulfillment, since these were all the prophecies, the three prophecies about the new name. Now we'll turn to Acts 11. We'll start with verse 25 to get the context. And but Acts 11:26 is the fulfillment of those three prophecies. But Acts 11:25 states, and now this is, I'm going to end up switching over. I'm going to read the New King James first. And unfortunately, there's a mistranslation here from what should have been an active verb to a passive verb. And as a result of this mistranslation to a passive verb, as you'll see, we don't know who does the naming here, but that's not the way the Greek was written. But we'll start with Acts 11, verse 25. Then Barnabas departed for Saul Tarsus to seek Saul. So here, this is in the context that word had come to Jerusalem to let them know of this great news that the Gentiles have had a great response, and many were baptized and became Christians in Antioch. And so when word came down to Jerusalem, the Christians there were greatly enthused and thankful that God had blessed the Gentiles in his kingdom by allowing the Gentiles to enter God's kingdom, and then very thankful that these previous very wicked and pagan Gentiles were receptive to God's kingdom. And so they had sent Barnabas to Antioch to help teach them. Well, the first thing that came to Barnabas's mind is, I need to go get Saul of Tarsus, who, of course, later his name is changed to Paul. And so he knew he needed him. He was the key to make this what's already success, but make it an overwhelming success and a lasting endeavor. And so, verse 26, and when he had found him, and so this is when Barnabas had found Paul, he brought him to Antioch. So it was that for a whole year they assembled, and this is correct, they, Paul and Barnabas, assembled with the church and taught a great many people. So Paul and Barnabas, this is the first thing. In the Greek, this is all one sentence, but it has three compound verbs, and they're all active infinitives. And I'll mention that here in a little bit. But anyway, so far the translation is exactly the way it should be. They assembled with the church and taught a great many people. That's the first two things that Paul and Barnabas did. And they are the antecedent who they refer to is Saul and Barnabas. They assembled and they taught with the congregation. Now here's the third thing, and then here's the mistranslation. And the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. Well, when you read that, who did the calling? Well, we don't know, because this translation doesn't tell us, because it's passive voice. And the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. Well, they were called Christians by who? Well, we don't know, but that is not the way that the Greek was written. Fortunately, we know from the Greek, and I don't know why, they turned an active noun, an active verb into a passive verb. And but the unfortunate effect of this mistranslation is, as Kaufman said, then so-called scholars through the years, they don't know what the name was, and they don't know who did this naming. And so they just suppose that it was the pagan Gentiles in Antioch called the disciples Christians first, and it was a term of derision and a term to ridicule them, Christian. And that's not it at all. This was God who named this name as a fulfillment of Isaiah's three prophecies. Now, the only translation that I've been able to find that accurately translated Acts 11:26 is Hugo McCord. And I was thankful that he translated it correctly, and I don't know why the others translated and changed an active verb that you would know who did the calling to a passive where you did not. So I'll read how it is straight. Hugo McCord translated this straight from the Greek into English, the way all the translations should have done. But anyway, Acts 11:26 from Hugo McCord's translation reads, "When he had found him," so whenever Barnabas had found Saul, "he brought Saul to Antioch. And it came to pass, even for a whole year, they were gathered together with the church, and they taught a large multitude, and first in Antioch, by a divine revelation, they called the disciples Christians." So, he knew there were three things, and there's three active infinitives in the Greek that Saul and Barnabas did, and it's all one sentence in the Greek, and they assembled, they taught, and they called, is what Paul and Barnabas did. And then in addition is what Kaufman will talk about here in what he wrote about this Acts 11:26 about this name, this word, Greek word that got translated is called. It's a special name, not the run-of-the-mill name that got translated as called. There were several names, several words in Greek that got translated as called. And he lists three total, but this one is a special one that means a divine revelation. And the Greek word is chromatizo, and it means by a divine revelation, meaning it's the mouth of the Lord, exactly what Isaiah had prophesied. The mouth of the Lord will name that, and he named it through the two prophets, Saul and Barnabas. And they were the actual humans that verbalized it, but they were speaking as the oracle of God. So I'll read now the commentary that Kaufman made on these two verses, Acts 11:25 and 26. "Some have speculated on the reasons which might have prompted Barnabas to search for Saul and bring him to Antioch. There are four probable reasons. First, Paul is a much-needed additional worker. Second, Paul and Barnabas are well acquainted. Third, Barnabas may have been led by inspiration to call the man who was to be the apostle to the Gentiles to the first great work with the Gentiles." So this is what Jesus had told Ananias, that this one that known as Saul of Tarsus, who had been an enemy of God's people and persecuted God's people, and Ananias was extremely hesitant to go and visit him and definitely to baptize him so he could become a Christian. But Jesus told him that he was going to be a special vessel and going to be an apostle to the Gentiles, and that this is something that Ananias needed to do. So Ananias then did, even though he was somewhat hesitant, maybe a little reluctant, but he did as Jesus commanded him. And so this is very likely, Kaufman said, why Barnabas went to Tarsus, just around on the northeast end of the Mediterranean Sea. So maybe 70 miles or so, something like from here to Lawton, is the distance that he traveled. And he may have even gotten on a boat and wouldn't have had to have walked all that way. And, you know, and maybe very likely that's what he did. But anyway, regardless, he went to Tarsus and found him and brought him back, because these were the Gentiles. So this is a very likely probability of a reason why, because Paul was going to be the apostle to the Gentiles. Now, Kaufman says, and most probably it was because the word of God had revealed to Ananias that Saul would bear the Lord's name. So Saul would bear the Lord's name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. And that was recorded in Acts 9:15. Now about Saul and Barnabas calling the disciples Christians. It must be noted that the Greek word chrematizo, translated as called, is always a divine call. And it's only used a few times. I looked it up, but I forgot now how many. I don't know, about 5, 6, or 7 times. And every time, it is by a divine revelation. That's why Kaufman translated that and put that in, to let us know that that's what that Greek word chrematizo means, by divine revelation. But it's the mouth of the Lord named, or it is a statement that is spoken by a prophet, God speaking through the prophet, as the oracles of God. So Kaufman continues, this is different from kaleo and phonio, which are correctly translated as just call. Those are not divinely call. And as you will notice, one of these, phonio or phoneo, that's where we get phone or telephone call. And it comes from this Greek word that meant call, but that is just, call that person over here. And that's not God doing the calling. And when God did the calling, then the Greek word was chrematizo instead of kaleo or phonio. And that should have let the translators there know, by it be chrematizo, that this was not a general run-of-the-mill call, but this was God doing the calling. The mouth of the Lord was naming this name Christian. As Moses was the mouthpiece of divine revelations, so were Saul and Barnabas mouthpieces of a divine revelation first prophesied to be from the mouth of the Lord in Isaiah 62, verse 2. God used Barnabas, a prophet, and Saul, an apostle, to call the disciples Christians. Therefore, the disciples were divinely called or divinely given the name Christian first at Antioch by Paul and Barnabas. And that's the unfortunate mistranslation, that it did not get construed in the translation that it was by Paul and Barnabas were doing the calling. So as a result, they say that the heathens were the one that came up with this name Christian. And instead of God, God coined this word and it was prophesied in Isaiah. There are three active infinitives in Acts 11:26 in the Greek. To assemble, to teach, and to divinely call. And the name is used only two other times. Peter encourages those who suffer as a Christian in 1 Peter 4:16, and later in Acts 26:28, where King Agrippa is almost persuaded to be a Christian. So that's how rarely, and that's how special this word Christian is, and God only used it three times in the entire Bible, which of course would only be in the New Testament. And two other places other than this initial calling, it is only written two other times, Acts 26:28 and 1 Peter 4:16. So we will end there, and Lord willing, we will continue about the article that Kaufman wrote about the new name. Is the name Christian? And Lord willing, we'll start that next week.